Our archaeological excursion for this month focuses on tribal artifacts returning to a tribe from far away. Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov of SULA bring in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of literally unearthing the past. This time around, we talk about the recently expanded Chachalu Museum of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, about midway between Salem and the Oregon coast. A display up now and well into next year showcases items that left the possession of the tribes long ago and have come home. Chelsea Rose from SULA in the studio with me once again. Always good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
We're looking for Mark Tveskov. You might not know where we are because we're in the new building, but we do have with us Brees Edwards, who is with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. He is the manager of the Historic Preservation Office. Brees, thank you for joining us today.
Certainly. Thank you.
I forgive me if I pronounce the name of the museum wrong, but tell us about the time and effort just getting the museum started.
The museum has been a goal of the tribe since restoration in the mid-80s. It's something that the tribe has been feels is a great way of helping to bring the story of the tribe out. For the past several decades, we've been working, and really in the past couple of years, have really been able to bring that home with doing adaptive reuse on a mid-century middle school here in Grand Ronde, and just opened officially with this new phase two on June 1.
All right, so it is very new then, essentially. Yeah.
Yes.
And what there is a significance to the name that you've chosen for the museum. Tell us about that.
It's a word that references the burned over place, the C-H-A or C-H-E in front of a word is, you know, demarks place of. So cha, in this case, it's a redundant cha-cha-lu. The place of the burned over place. And that's the description of the land that the tribes of Grand Ronde found when they were relocated to this part of the Yamhill Valley.
And the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde actually came from quite a few different far-flung parts of Oregon, didn't they?
Yes. 27, well, close to 30 tribes and bands throughout western Oregon, including southwest Washington, all the way down to the California border.
So the rogue people of the Rogue River country ended up there too, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So was when you mentioned the museum being in this burned over place, was that part of the reason that it was given to Native Americans? It was like it was land considered worthless by the people in power?
I can't really point to anything. I think that it may be any number of reasons, but I think that also what it may have been considered to, whether deliberately or otherwise, to have not had any value when relocating community here, but community that utilized and engaged with fire as a management tool were able to understand what was waiting in the next seasons because of what fire had done to this place.
So there was a sense of some opportunity there?
Yes.
So what kinds of things did you do just in the designing of the museum to help tell the story of people in place?
We took a slightly different approach. We've looked at landscape and people, places, and practice, if you will. Those elements kind of comprising a tripod of understanding. So elements look at in a, one of the exhibit areas, it's a, a river scene with stone artifacts as well as some botanical fiber, weaving materials. And that allows us to talk about how far afield those botanical materials are coming and how complex and engaged this given place is in practice and connection throughout the landscape.
This is our Underground History segment on the Jefferson Exchange. Brees Edwards is with us with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. He's the manager of the Historic Preservation Office. Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology with me once again. Questions and comments from you, welcome by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So then talk about, Brees, if you would, the things you could put in a museum. I mean, part of the problem is that when you are uprooted from your homeland and marched hundreds of miles away, it's not like you can take a lot of your history with you.
No, absolutely. What that brings is, you know, literally what you can carry and what you are able to, you know, then develop through trade or purchase or, you know, self-manufacture once you're at your new destination. So for Grand Ronde, that can lead to, I think, one of the conversation points here today, the Summers collection from England, where in the 1870s we had the Reverend Summers acquire through purchase and trade over 200 objects from just the Grand Ronde Reservation.
So these ended up in the British Museum ultimately, is that right?
Yes. Through a rather circuitous path, the Reverend Summers was relocated from the Grand Ronde area down to California. At that point, his collection was sold to a fellow missionary, a Reverend Freer, who returned to England in the late 1800s, and then in 1900 turned that collection over to the British Museum.
Chelsea Rose, help us out here, because obviously things have changed quite a bit in archaeology. We've managed to go several months now without invoking the name of Indiana Jones, but I'm afraid that's still the impression a lot of people are left with. Now, that movie itself was set in the 30s, so people should not take too much stock in that. But archaeology used to be essentially a plundering, didn't it?
Yeah, and there was, in the 19th century, a real big trend for people to kind of go on these expeditions to get stuff to populate these ethnography museums that are still around Europe. And they would go up and down, you know, not just the Americas, but all over the world, to collect things from indigenous peoples that they felt at the time, if you wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt, they felt like they were saving these traditions and they were helping to preserve these cultural histories.
But generally far from the cultures though, right?
Yeah. So that's the challenge, is some of these things that were very perishable maybe have survived that otherwise wouldn't perhaps, but they're so far to the folks who created them and who they have greater importance in some ways. So for example, stuff in the British Museum is important to the Grand Ronde tribe, but not everybody has the means or the time to get all the way over to London to check this stuff out. So I think it's really cool that now a lot of these museums that have these collections are starting to recognize that, how can we partner with the folks that created these materials, their descendants, and how can we help, you know, maybe not, it's not always an easy option to send stuff back, but how can we partner and provide better access?
So from your knowledge of the business, then, what is the general set of rules, if there are any, that seem to be generally accepted about repatriation or not?
Well, that's a very contested issue, and I think it depends on, you know, people in Greece and England, all over the world, people are different governments and stuff are trying to get cultural items back. I think I read on an article in this exhibit, and Brees can probably speak more to this, that in the British Museum, it would take an act of Congress for them to actually repatriate those items. So maybe Brees can speak more to that. So this is a creative solution in the short term to help, again, provide access. I've heard other accounts of museums providing funding to bring, like, native basket weavers over to their museum so they can look through the collections and provide, not only have access to it, but provide a lot of knowledge that's important to better interpreting and understand the context of those materials.
So, Brees, in the case of what you have now from the British Museum, these pieces are visiting, they're not staying necessarily?
Correct. We entered into an institution-to-institution loan. you know, one museum to another for a 12-month loan of these current 16 objects. And the article is right in saying that it's an act of parliament for the British Museum to divest of any object that it has. And that goes back to a piece of legislation that was passed through Parliament in, I believe, the early 1900s that made the British Museum the People's Museum. And in doing that, it recognized that all objects within its collections belong to all of the people of England. And so through government, it has to, you know, divest.
So that the representatives of the people have to be the ones to agree to part with essentially the possessions of the people.
Exactly.
This is our underground history segment here on the Jefferson Exchange. Chelsea Rose joins us once again from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Brees Edwards is with us as well. He's the Historic Preservation Office Manager at the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. The Grand Ronde has opened up the Chachalo Museum, and a phase two recently opened with a display called Rise of the Collectors, with pieces from the British Museum that used to belong to people in one of the tribes or several of the tribes of Grand Ronde. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Questions, comments, welcome at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Does the rise of the collectors in the title imply that it was more than just the collection of the British Museum? It was a bunch of people?
Yes. We're trying to bring attention to this concept of collecting and almost a hoarding. So we also have on loan objects from the Oregon Historical Society of the Kershaw, who had been a surgeon here at the reservation and then became the agent for Grand Ronde. And he acquired a quite extensive basket collection as well as small objects. And then through our own collection, we have objects that are also on display. To talk about the different ways of collecting and what that means. I think Chelsea brought up the concept of how people felt that they were doing a service to provide proof of the past for some point in the future. And that bears out in the materials that Reverend Summers wrote, that he kept extensive notes about his negotiations for objects, and he often references how he's trying to prove that these will be the sole surviving evidence of the people of the 1870s, of tribal community. He got half of it right. He was able to save these objects for this point in the future, but Grand Ronde and the people of Grand Ronde are still here today.
And happy to be talking about this, yes. Chelsea?
Yeah, and one of the things I think is so awesome about this exhibit is not only that they were able to go through a fairly tedious bureaucratic process to get the stuff back, even if temporary, but when you see more and more commonly a lot of Oregon tribes are creating their own museum facilities, and that's a really great way for tribal folks for the first time to control the narrative. Like, here's stuff that came from our land or our folks that are enrolled in the tribe or part of the tribe, and here's the way we want to tell this story. Here's the facets that we think are important, and here's how ties into the modern population. And to follow up on what Brees was saying, that is one of the things that's problematic about how some of these artifacts are exhibited in in Europe or wherever these ethnography museums sometimes are, is it makes it seem like you're viewing a very static moment in the past, that it's an extinct culture. And obviously this culture is not extinct. They just created a museum, so they're still there today. And I think that it's really important for them to kind of show how this is part of a dynamic culture that's still there and still these things from the past still have relevance.
And so, Brees, are the skills still there? I mean, have some of the crafts and things that made some of the baskets, for example, are those crafts still present and the knowledge still possessed by tribal members?
Absolutely. And the 16 objects that were identified to come back in for this, albeit short visit, reflect skills and techniques and are serving as a revitalization in those, in fact. We've started to design 12 months of classes for community to reacquaint with some of these techniques, whether it's using iris fiber for weaving or the particular weave style of a basket.
We were talking about Reverend Summers and Dr. Kershaw, who both worked with the tribes at the reservation, and I'm sure they identify themselves as friends. They had a level of caring, it appears, about the people at whatever level. But then, there's probably other stuff out there in the world that was not dealt with as carefully. I mean, what can you do to try to put the call out that you would like to see some things that are connected to the tribes of Grand Ronde return to the tribes?
It's a really interesting subject to talk about, and one that can become complicated in terms of museums today are often based in the materials that they have and their ability to collaborate in their presentation of those objects and to come and have a conversation about what may or may not be in a collection can be a sensitive one. At its most base, though, is getting some foundation for understanding of whose materials they've been caring for the past century and a half, two centuries. For instance, the spelling of the word Kalapuya that may be on a reference card for a collection can have up to 20 different spellings.
Oh, wow. I thought I just saw two. 20, that's amazing.
So oftentimes it's about taking the time to work with the curators and collections managers to help them understand that through their record keeping, the different spellings that they may need to keep an eye out for.
One of the things I also think is really important to keep in mind, too, is that these 16 objects or whatever, they are, as archaeologists, we put a lot of stock in artifacts as physical representations of choice, opportunity, all those things. But as a collection, they represent one person's view of what was important about the tribe in 1870s, and that person was not a tribal member. So if you were to have an opportunity to have a tribal member pick 16 artifacts that perhaps represented what they felt were important aspects of the tribe, it would probably look very different. So a lot of times, even though folks thought they were saving these cultures and these artifacts, it's not only a pretty paternalistic view of like, I'm going to save you, but also it's an outsider's view. So it's, there's a lot of, context that's important to keep in mind when we think about what survived and why. It's political.
Well, is there also a difference in the way then that some people or organizations think about artifacts relative to certain cultures? I mean, it seems like, there's this sense of like, oh, we should repatriate the stuff of ancient Greece or ancient Egypt, perhaps. Are the feelings different about Native American tribes that you find in your work?
Well, I think sometimes there are, I don't have a lot of personal experience with Egyptian or Greek artifacts because we're so far removed, so I'm more familiar with the Native artifacts, and there are a lot of efforts to repatriate items that are of significance to the tribe. But a lot of times it comes down to, again, government power and politics. If you have the entire government of a country trying to go after a museum to get those artifacts back, it's that carries a lot more weight than a single tribe trying to tackle. They don't always have the resources to take on these institutions. So, but that said, most institutions have people working at them that care about this stuff and understand the more problematic, parts of this. So I think it's really cool that they were able to work one-on-one with this museum to kind of come up with a creative solution to get around some of these larger obstacles for the short term.
So, Brees, are there other collections out there that you have your eyes on or that even exist that you have begun negotiations on to replace the stuff that goes back to the British Museum, I guess, next May?
We've actually started conversations with the British Museum about a possible round two to identify other objects to come in. We're still looking at our own, you know, timelines for and subjects that we want to use the exhibit space to present and educate through. However, there are Grand Ron materials spread throughout North America, as well as many of the European collections that we are aware of. And, you know, is it something that we want all of it back? I think there's an importance of understanding that there is connection, and that oftentimes connection can occur even when distant. For instance, the Summers collection is visited more than a few times every year by individuals of community going to London, knowing that the collection is there and seeking an audience with several of the belongings that are there, because they know that these belongings were acquired from their great auntie or uncle or parent, grandparent. So in that sense, Grand Ron is now putting its place now in London.
All right. So quickly, if you would, Breeze, give us the correct pronunciation of the name of the museum and when it's open.
Chichalu, mm-hmm. And we're open 10 to 4, Tuesday through Friday.
Tuesday through Friday, 10 to 4 at Grand Ron. Breeze Edwards is the manager of the Historic Preservation Office at the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ron. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
And I want to let people know that we have a live Underground History roadshow again coming up on Monday, August 6th. So Chelsea, Mark, and I will be at the Bella Union in Jacksonville. It's the Mastodon Roadshow. We'll learn some things about mastodons, both true and false. So dinner and drinks at 6 if you want to give yourself, then you have to buy them, yes. The program starts at 7, Bella Union in Jacksonville. We'll see you for Underground History Live. Chelsea Rose, always good to see you here in the studio.
Great to be here.